Funding for Think comes from SMU's Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to an archive edition of Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What is the life story of the Atlantic Ocean? From the earliest days of human consciousness, the Atlantic has been a source of mystery, wonder, power, and terror. And given the endless interaction between the great ocean's expanse and the efforts of humankind to understand and navigate it, author Simon Winchester thought the Atlantic worthy of a biography of sorts based on the seven ages of man Shakespeare described in As You Like It. His new book is called Atlantic: Great Sea Battles, Heroic Discoveries, Titanic Storms, and a Vast Ocean of a Million Stories. Simon, welcome back to Think.
Thanks a lot.
You call the Atlantic the grandest ocean on the planet. What makes it more so in a geopolitical sense than, say, the Pacific or Indian Oceans?
Well, I did actually write a book about the Pacific about 20 years ago when I was living in Hong Kong, because everyone there was saying the Pacific is the ocean of the future, and you've got the great Asian tiger economies and California and Chile and all these important places around it. And so I dutifully traveled all around the Pacific from sort of Kamchatka to Chile and from Alaska down to Australia, and wrote a book. But the problem with the book, I realized after it came out, was that it might well have been true that the Pacific was the ocean of the future, but what it really wasn't was the ocean of the past in terms of human history. And apart from the Polynesian navigations, there wasn't a great deal of interest to talk about in terms of a hugely long human legacy. And I realized sort of in an instant, having written this book and was sort of looking at the wreckage of it, because it wasn't much of a success, that the problem was that I had chosen the wrong ocean, and that if any ocean in the world could really be said to be in sort of ineluctably conjoined with the story of humankind, it was the Atlantic. And so armed with the sort of idea that the Mediterranean, I think most people would agree, was the inland sea of classical civilization, then it's sort of only a hop, skip, and a jump to saying, well, if that was the case, then certainly the Atlantic is the inland sea of modern Western civilization, and had heaps and heaps of history. And so I decided to look at that, essentially based on the mistake of having chosen the Pacific 20 years before.
So the first stage that you look at is the Atlantic's infancy. And people may not realize this, but you're actually a geologist by training. Can you tell us a little bit about what the Earth was like before the birth of the Atlantic as we know it today?
Yes, I think it's generally accepted now that since about 2.6 billion years ago, the world has had a number of what are now called supercontinents. The very first one was a sort of coalescence of little bodies of land into something about 1,500 miles wide, shaped a bit like an albatross in flight. That was the supercontinent known as Ur, like Ur of the Chaldees. And since then, a number of other bodies have grown up, and sometimes they've disappeared, and sometimes they've amalgamated into really, really huge supercontinents. Well, that process has been going on for a long, long time, until we get to a situation about 200 million years ago, relatively recently in geological time, when the world consisted essentially of two things: one supercontinent known as Pangaea, and surrounding it one super ocean called Panthalassa. And then what happened was that due to convection currents within the inner part of the core and due to tectonic plate movement, this supercontinent, Pangaea, split in two. And in doing so, water from the surrounding sea, Panthalassa, started to gush into the gap, and that was the beginning of what would lead to the Atlantic Ocean. It didn't really assume the shape it has, the sort of S-shaped appearance that it has today, until about 40 or 50 million years ago. But 200 million years ago is when it was born. 50 million years ago is when it became shaped like it is today.
And the very first modern humans would have known only the Atlantic Ocean, is that right?
Yes, I mean, that's I find quite an extraordinary story, and it's fairly accurately dated as well. 164,000 years ago, humankind had been, if we accept that humankind was itself founded or created or firstborn in Ethiopia, and people, humanoids, and then humans moving southwards through the savannas and the forests of Africa. And about 164,000 years ago, they come to a place when, oddly enough, nowadays there's a golf course in South Africa and a cliff, and the cliff is known as Pinnacle Point. And these early humans must have been utterly astonished by what they saw, because behind them was forest and grassland and elephants and lions and all that sort of thing. Ahead of them was this limitless body of water. They'd never seen anything like that before. And they were, I imagine, terrified and overwhelmed by what they saw. They shinned down the cliff, and there's a cave, an enormous cave, known to archaeologists, and specifically in Arizona, where they've been studying it a lot, as PP-13B. And in this cave, they sheltered and made their first forays to the tidal pools that they found beside the sea. And from those tide pools, they took their first seafood. And it's an extraordinary thing that, there's a common Western saying, I think, ascribed nowadays to G.K. Chesterton, that it was a brave man who ate the first oyster. Well, it apparently was the first man who ate the first oyster, because that's what the floor of the cave is littered with, oyster shells. And so here we have, 164,000 years ago, mankind feasting on oysters and marking with ochre chalk, as it were, the tide pools that had a lot of food, and indicating on the wall of the cave which pools had more food than others, thereby initiating some kind of written communication. So everything changed the moment humans first saw the sea.
Now, it was not until the Phoenicians that humans apparently started traveling on the oceans. Is that right?
Yes, and that also, I mean, if you can imagine it, rather like the seminal moment for the early humans, a similar seminal moment for the Phoenicians, who were traders in the Mediterranean Sea, and they occupy, you know, sailing out from their ports in the Levant, like Tyre and Sidon, and they managed to sail all the way westwards, right out to Spain, to places like Malaga, but still within the Mediterranean Sea, which is a relatively benign sort of body of water. Beyond the Pillars of Hercules, which were what the ancients called Gibraltar on the right-hand side and a cliff called Jebel Musa on the left-hand side, beyond that, if you looked out from the relative calm of the Mediterranean, you'd see this furious, very different sea, which Homer called, you know, the Sea of Perpetual Gloom. It was foggy, gigantic waves, big storms. That we now know was the Atlantic, but they didn't dare go out into it because they assumed it was monsters and the edge of the world.
Yeah.
But then, in about the 7th century BC, a group of Phoenician sailors decided, to heck with it, let's go exploring. And they went out. It must have been an amazing epiphany for them. They went out beyond Gibraltar into this new body of water, and in their tiny little boats, which were called, tiny little boats called hippoi, they turned left and went down the coast of what we now know as Morocco, and they came to a group of islands, which are located by the port of what we now call Essaouira. There are a group of two or three islands, which are now called the Ile Pourpuraire, the Purple Islands. And the reasons they were called the Purple Islands is because the Phoenicians found, clinging to the rocks around these islands, tens of thousands of little, well, actually rather large, snail-like creatures, which we now know to be a gastropod called Murex brandaris. And these Murex were filled with the body of the snail, which if you used a rather complicated process, you could extract from the snails an indelible, beautiful, purple-colored dye. And that dye was much prized in the Mediterranean, particularly by the Romans, who used it to dye their clothes to denote that they were members of the aristocracy.
And it cost more than gold.
Indeed it did. I mean, and to this day, I mean, we have phrases like, he's born to the purple, because purple is associated with nobility. So the Phoenicians traded these murex shells, brought them back to the Mediterranean and sold them to the Romans and the Greeks and whoever else was buying. And that was the first trade. So it was commerce. It was market forces that initially drove humankind into this fearsome body of water, the Atlantic.
So, Simon, I am Irish by descent, and my people like to talk about St. Brendan. But as far as you can find, it was indeed Leif Erikson and the Vikings who made the first crossing across the Atlantic. Is that right?
Yes, and I mean, no disrespect to you as an Irish lady. St. Brendan, formidably courageous. I mean, good Lord, I lived for a long time in Western Scotland, and those seas are horrendous, particularly in winter. He and the very small boat, I mean, a curragh, very, you know, relative by today's standards, primitive, went northwards to the Faroe Islands and then turned westwards to Iceland. And all of this has been chronicled by this remarkable Irish sailor called Tim Severin, who has repeated what he believed the voyage of the St. Brendan ships. But there's no evidence that St. Brendan got further west than Iceland. But there is evidence, however, that in 1001 AD, about 500 years later, this very courageous Norwegian called Leif Erikson did make it. And he was the first person that we know of, first European, to have landed and built a settlement in the New World. And he did that in Newfoundland, the settlement at a place called L'Anse aux Meadows, which means the Bay of the Jellyfish in French Canadian, is in western Newfoundland. And there is this, it was only discovered in 1960, this settlement of sod-covered houses, and there are sort of iron workings and various tools and so forth inside these houses. And we now know from the record that the first European to be born in North America was conceived and indeed born there. And he was a child with the wonderful name of Snorri Thorfinnsson. And he was born in about 1002, but like the rest of the settlers, they decided the weather and the conditions were just too arduous, and they legged it back to Norway. And so Snorri, born in North America, died back in Europe.
It's funny that he is no household word today. Everybody thinks about Virginia Dare, who didn't get there for 1,000 years later.
I know. It's. I'm going to make myself terribly unpopular with this book in Italian restaurants all over America will not allow me in, because I say, hold on a minute, Columbus was not the one that it's Leif Erikson got there 500 years before Christopher Columbus, and I think we should honor Erikson much more than he is. Only Wisconsin and Minnesota, I think, give him any honor at all. He's generally forgotten.
What kind of technology did the Vikings have that allowed them to make it across this freezing cold expanse of water?
Well, they did have extremely well-built, very, very sturdy boats, for a start, with very good and efficient sails, not multi-sailed. I mean, that didn't come until the 15th and 16th centuries, so largely single or maybe two sails, and an immense amount of courage. And also it has to be said that, unlike Columbus, and obviously I'm not going to completely rubbish Columbus, because he did the journey in essentially one bound all the way across the Atlantic, whereas Erikson and his chums did it in relatively small progressions. They'd go from Stavanger in southern Norway to the Faroe Islands, which is sort of 600 or 700 miles, and then another few hundred to Iceland, and then another few hundred to Greenland, and then eventually across a pretty ferocious body of sea, the Labrador Sea, to Newfoundland. But these were not long journeys. They were relatively short hops, and I think that was the Vikings had that going for them.
And obviously they would have taken food, but they could also have caught food while they were en route?
Indeed they did. I mean, they like the Basques that followed them, they became very adept at dealing with cod and drying it and using that as a source of all sorts of vitamins and proteins to sustain them in their voyage. And of course, as we know all too well, the Basques perfected the technique of salting and preserving cod for their long voyages across the Atlantic. So the cod fish is hugely important to many early North American travelers.
Author Simon Winchester is my guest. His new book is called Atlantic: Great Sea Battles, Heroic Discoveries, Titanic Storms, and a Vast Ocean of a Million Stories. We'll be back in a couple of minutes.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Continuing and Professional Education, announcing a 9-month intensive CFP certificate program starting in January in Plano. You can learn more at smu.edu/CFP.
You're listening to an archive edition of Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is author Simon Winchester. His newest book is called Atlantic: Great Sea Battles, Heroic Discoveries, Titanic Storms, and a Vast Ocean of a Million Stories. So we know, Simon, that in due time, most of the nations of Western Europe found their way across the Atlantic. What's the best explanation for why we don't really hear any stories whatsoever of voyages that originated on the western side of the Atlantic?
It is odd, isn't it? I mean, there's something of a maritime tradition in the Aztecs to a small degree, but there's one port, but it's generally thought that it was only for coastal trading, and there's very little suggestion at all that they ever ventured very far out into the ocean itself. And particularly surprising because if you're on the west side of the ocean, it's relatively easy. Most of the winds are prevailing in the right direction. The currents are likely to take you towards Europe with much greater ease than people going from Europe to the Americas, where you're battling against both winds, tides, and currents. So it's an abiding mystery. There's some vague suggestion that Columbus, when he was in Ireland, that he may have seen the bodies of two Carib sailors who might have come from the Caribbean somehow to Ireland. But even that is somewhat fanciful. There's marginalia in a book that he had in which he talks very vaguely and elusively about seeing some Caribs in Ireland. There are also some other stories that suggest that the early Inuit people in Newfoundland, the Beartuck they're called, might have made voyages to Iceland and possibly even Norway. But that aside, it's very, very limited, and it remains a major puzzle as to why they decided to stick to their own country and not explore Europe.
The Atlantic has always been a source of astonishment and inspiration for those who have encountered it. Can you talk a little bit about your favorite creations in the what you consider the lover's phase?
Yes, I mean, I tried to deal in this chapter with the poetry that's been born of the ocean and the music that's been born from the Atlantic and indeed the art. But I think what particularly captured my imagination most of all was the architecture. The cities that are either on the Atlantic or in the Atlantic that pay, as it were, homage to the ocean that they stand beside. We tend to take so many cities for granted and stand on the side of the ocean and forget their oceanic roots. But if you go to sea, for instance, off Liverpool, now Liverpool is a classic example. If you approach Liverpool by land, if you drive from London to Liverpool, it's a pretty ugly city, to be perfectly honest. But if you look at it from the ferry, if you go out and stand off 3 or 4 miles and look at Liverpool and look at the Royal Liver Building and you look at all the great customs houses that line the seafront, then you think, my gosh, this is a city which was built out of the sea. It pays respect to the sea. Once you've got that sort of viewpoint, then you start to look at cities in a different way. You see New York, for instance, as a city, and you only see this in Lower Manhattan, as a city which is very much respectful of its origins as a maritime trading city. You see the same thing in cities like Montevideo or Rio or Buenos Aires. And Cape Town. Cape Town is another wonderful example of a city that really is an obvious maritime city, and its architecture reflects that. But my particular favorite is a very obscure city, hardly a city really, it's more just a village, but it's on the island of St. Helena, which is the island in the middle of the Atlantic, really. It's about 1,000 miles west of Angola. It's a little British colonial possession, an island with just 5,000 people. It's where Napoleon was exiled after his defeat at Waterloo, where indeed he died. And the capital is a little town called Jamestown. You can only get there by ship. There's no airport, although there ominously is talk of building one. But Jamestown is an absolutely beautiful confection of maritime architecture. There's a little castle, a little cathedral, a little customs house. Everything in 17th century pastel colors, absolutely unaltered by time, and all the motifs are seahorses and mermaids and all the kind of and fish and so forth. Looking at it from the sea and being there, you think this is a city which is an Atlantic city and all the more beautiful for it.
My guest is author Simon Winchester. His new book is called Atlantic. Let's go to the phones now and we'll speak with Kevin in Dallas. Hello, Kevin.
Hello.
Hi, go right ahead, please.
Yes, Mr. Winchester, I was going to ask you, if you remember back in the 70s, the Ra and the Ra 2 project, where they tried to sail papyrus boats from Africa to South America to establish some kind of a link with the Egyptian culture and the Mesoindian cultures?
I do. This is Thor Heyerdahl again, who did the Kon-Tiki expedition in the across the
Pacific. Yeah. And are you aware of any evidence that that theory was even, you know, plausible?
Well, I don't. From what I can remember of the Ra voyage, it was not an ultimate success in the way that the Kon-Tiki expedition was. So I think this is sort of collapse of stout party, as they say, that the theory might have been fascinating, but it wasn't really substantively proven, despite Heyerdahl's hope for it. It just wasn't a great success. I mean, interestingly, going back to the earlier question about evidence of American things having been found in Europe or Africa, there is this suggestion that coca leaves were found in some Egyptian sarcophagi, suggesting that there may have been Caribs got into them, into the Mediterranean, and found themselves all the way down into Egypt. But these are terribly fanciful, and I think there's very little proof of even the Ra voyages that this was anything at all significant.
The soldier age might be the one that we most associate when we think about the history of the Atlantic. We've fought wars over it. We've fought wars in it. We've also fought pirates. Can you talk for a minute about how real pirates compare with the ones of our imagination?
Yes, I think if one of the things that this chapter tries to do is to dispel some of the myths about piracy. I mean, piracy, and I think we understand a bit more about the realities of piracy today with all the nastiness of the Horn of Africa. It was a frightful business in the 17th century in the Caribbean and in the Atlantic, frustrating the galleon trade between the Spanish Main and Spain. The pirates were brutally cruel people, and if I can just use, and I don't want to upset anybody, but one of the punishments which was relatively common, which indicates that they were something more sinister than simply, you know, chaps with peg legs and parrots on their shoulders singing yo-ho-ho and a bottle of rum. They weren't anything as romantically attractive as that. One of the punishments was that the pirates would swarm on board, and anyone that gave them any lip or trouble, they would slit his stomach open with a scimitar, pull out his intestines, nail them to the mainmast, and then force him by whipping him or attacking him with swords to dance backwards on the deck of the ship, unraveling his intestines as he did so. I mean, that's an image which, once you read about it, it stays with you hauntingly forever, and that's more of the reality of pirates than we might read in Robert Louis Stevenson or something like that.
The other, of course, horrendous crime that sort of stains the reputation of the Atlantic is the Middle Passage. And human beings were essentially used as a commodity in triangular trade.
Yes, I mean, that is utterly shameful. And, of course, we, the British, I'm afraid, bear an awful degree of responsibility. And a lot of British wealth, which is still the sort of wealth that we see as tourists, you know, great castles and houses and libraries, was built on the slave trade and the Middle Passage. I mean, basically, to summarize the kind of thing that went on, is that slaving ships would leave ports like Bristol and Liverpool and head southwards filled with trade goods, which they would take to the West African ports in places like Ghana, and they would sell the trade goods, and they would then disappear into the African interior. The merchants would then go to these extraordinarily elaborate, actually rather beautiful, but terribly, the purpose was very sinister, these buildings known as the slaving castles, and the most famous, I suppose, is the Cape Coast Castle, which I think President Obama took his family to a year or so ago. That's in Ghana. And there the slaves who would have been collected in the interior of West Africa would be brought in shackles and kept in dungeons. Then they would be passed through these infamous gates of no or doors of no return, put onto these ships that had carried the trade goods down, and they would, in the most appalling circumstances, they were just given terrible food, and there was virtually no exercise and no fresh air, and they were stored almost like logs of wood below deck, taken across terrified people across the Middle Passage, which was often a terribly stormy crossing, either to the Barracoons, the islands where the slaves were stored, or to the actual slave markets in places like Savannah and Mobile, where they would be sold. And then the boats would be scrubbed down with lye and cleansed, and onto them would be loaded tobacco and cotton, and the ships would head off from the American ports back to Bristol and Liverpool. And it was an enormously profitable business. But it is the stories, and I've collected a few of them, from the experience of slaves on board, was so dreadful, so degrading, so cruel. It's just a terrible blot on Atlantic history.
11 million souls over 400 years or so.
And the most recent, the last surviving member, a chap called Cudjoe Lewis, died in America, I think, in 1935. Hmm. So there was still illegal trading going on in the 1860s, and he was on one of the last boats.
Simon Winchester is my guest. His new book is called Atlantic, Great Sea Battles, Heroic Discoveries, Titanic Storms, and a Vast Ocean of a Million Stories. We'll go back to the phones now. This time we'll speak with Ed in Arlington. Hi, Ed.
Hi. I got a couple points. The first one would be regarding the wondering earlier as to why there was no exploration of the Atlantic from west to east. I thought it was fairly well established and understood that what led to the age of exploration from the Old World westward by the Western European countries was the development of the chronometer, the watch, as well as the compass. I'm not certain that Columbus had the benefit of both of those devices, but most of the explorers afterwards certainly did, and those devices did not exist in the New World until they were brought there by Western Europeans. That would be the fairly pretty straightforward explanation of why there was no west-to-east exploration, I believe.
Yeah, can you talk about that technology? The compass seems so obvious to us now, but it wasn't always available.
Yes, I mean, I talk about it quite a lot in the book, and yes, indeed make that point. But on the other hand, there was navigation in the Pacific, which didn't require either the chronometer or the compass, accomplished by the Polynesian navigators. So there was, if I can put it crudely, there were native abilities to navigate. And going back to the point that I made earlier about prevailing winds and currents and so forth, it would have been, if I say relatively easy, I mean, the stress is on the word relatively, to navigate from the New World to the Old, had there been any desire to do so. I mean, it simply was made a great deal easier to navigate once it was possible to determine longitude, once accurate chronometers had been invented. But it still remains puzzling that if the Polynesians did it, why didn't any of the literal people of the New World attempt to do it either? It's a puzzle.
So the Atlantic was also obviously a route to a new kind of freedom for people who came from the Old World of their own volition. Can you talk a little bit about what the ocean itself has represented to immigrants?
Yes, I mean, I'm slightly diverting from the point. I think it's rather fascinating that so many European cities, so many cities around the world generally, erect statues to great explorers, you know, like Christopher Columbus would be in Genoa, and Magellan would be in Punta Arenas, and Henry the Navigator would be in southern Portugal. But in America, in New York specifically, the dominating statue is not to a person, but it is to an idea. The Statue of Liberty is a monument to the idea of freedom. And that is essentially what lured people across the ocean in the millions in the closing part of the 19th and the early part of the 20th century. And I find the whole immigrant story, and of course Robert Louis Stevenson in The Amateur Emigrant captures it absolutely magnificently, in considerable discomfort going across the ocean, mainly to New York City from the ports of Europe, simply to become part of this extraordinary experiment which was the United States. And of course the Atlantic was absolutely central to that. Sure enough, yes, in later years the Pacific was important specifically for Chinese immigration, but the bulk of what drove this country's early years was European emigration, and all of it had to come by way of the Atlantic Ocean.
You write in the beginning of the book about your first experience crossing the Atlantic in 1963. Can you tell us about what you remember about that trip?
Yes, I'll never forget it. I mean, I was a youngster at the time, and I had a year off between high school and going up to Oxford, and so I decided I wanted to see America. I wanted to hitchhike around when it was safe and easy to do so. And so I saved up my money and eventually got the earliest ship out from Liverpool to Montreal. It was called the Empress of Britain. And it was an amazing journey. I won't say it was like the immigrant experience, although I was way down in what might be called steerage. There were certainly no portholes in my cabin. And I had a rather interesting experience just the other day. I remembered vividly that in the cabin next to me on the Empress of Britain, there were three young women from Blackburn in Lancashire. And the other day, I was in Cheltenham in southern England and giving a talk about this book, and I mentioned this memorable journey on the Empress of Britain. Well, afterwards, at the book signing, there were line of people, and the fifth or sixth person in the line was a middle-aged lady who came up to me and she said, "I'm terribly sorry, I wasn't able to come to your talk, but I've been looking for you for the last 20 years or so. I have one question. Where have you ever been on a ship called the Empress of Britain?"
Let me have you stop there because we need to take a break, and I think we know where this is going, but,
okay.
But I can't wait to hear the rest of the story. Simon Winchester is with us. We're talking about his new book, Atlantic.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Continuing and Professional Education, announcing a 9-month intensive CFP certificate program starting in January in Plano. You can learn more at smu.edu/CFP.
I'm Chris Boyd. You're listening to an archive edition of Think. My guest this hour is author Simon Winchester. His newest book is called Atlantic: Great Sea Battles, Heroic Discoveries, Titanic Storms, and a Vast Ocean of a Million Stories. So, Simon, this woman who found you at the book signing, was she your neighbor on the Empress of Britain?
Indeed, she turned out to be. I mean, it was extraordinary. I said, "Well, yes, I was on the Empress of Britain." She said, "I'm so relieved. Look at this." And she pulled out of her handbag a diary. And she opened up to the front first page, 30th of April, 1963, emigrating to Canada, ! This is the first day of my new life. I've just got on the ship called the Empress of Britain. We've just had lifeboat drill. There was a rainstorm as we left Liverpool. But then I met this young boy called Simon, who's going to hitchhike across America, and he bought us a bottle of wine. And then we paid cards for the rest of the evening. And I just thought this was utterly amazing. And it was her. She was one of the three girls from Blackburn that were in the cabin next to me.
What a remarkable story of what a small world it's become.
I know. It was just the people behind her in the signing queue. They just thought this was theater live. Because I was speechless. It was wonderful.
And, you know, it's an experience that most of us will never have because we don't travel across the Atlantic in ocean liners very much anymore.
Well, in these days, the ocean liners that you do travel on do their level best to divorce you from the realities of the ocean. They don't rock and roll because they've got so many stabilizers. They're full of shops and gambling salons and things. I've vowed that if I'm ever invited to talk about this book while crossing the Atlantic, which I hope I will be, I'm going to make sure that I do the talk on the deck so that people feel the wind and the rain and smell the salt and see the seagulls. So none of this casino hopping when you're with me, I'm afraid.
Well, and we have learned more than once, I suppose most notably with the sinking of the Titanic, that our hubris in believing that we have controlled this great force of nature is to our peril.
Indeed. I mean, it's absolutely, it'll be the master of us all in the end. And that is we mistreat the ocean. And I think that's towards the end of the book, I try and, in not a preachy way, but I try and remind people that we are not as kind to the ocean and as respectful to the ocean as we ought to be. And there are one or two areas which we're particularly derelict. And one of them is our attitude to the fish. I mean, most notably, the whole business of what happened to the cod fishery off Newfoundland in the 1990s. This was a part of the world, the Grand Banks, where the cod was so numerous that people said you sometimes felt you could almost walk from Iceland to North America on the backs of these enormous silvery fish that were everywhere. They were so numerous you could almost pluck them from the water. But then, for reasons concerned both with greed and with politics, I'm afraid to say, the Canadian government made a series of terrible decisions in the 1990s, and the consequence is there is no cod left off Newfoundland at all. This was a part of the world that had as its unofficial motto, "In cod we trust." Well, there isn't any cod left, and you can't do that kind of thing to the sea. And so I'm afraid the last chapter is essentially about the way that we have disrespected, we've polluted the sea, we've overfished it, we've treated it less well than it ought to be treated. And it is going to get its own back eventually.
You write about the predicted demise of the Atlantic, which is not, it may very well come sooner in terms of the living things in the ocean and what depends on the ocean. But geology, once again, will change the shape of the Atlantic in another couple of hundred million years.
Yes, I mean, there's a subset of extremely clever people who use the sort of geological futurists, and many in your part of the world, actually, who are predicting with a series of very complex mathematical models how the continents will move from here on in. And one of the theories has it that Cape Horn, if you at the southern tip of South America, will, over the next several score million years, will move eastwards across the southern Atlantic, will pass south of South Africa, will continue moving eastwards across the Indian Ocean, will fetch up south of Tasmania, south of Australia, will set Australia turning in a sort of anti-clockwise direction, and Cape Horn will then start moving northwards until ultimately it collides with Singapore. I mean, this sounds completely fanciful, but that's what some of these mathematical models predict. And when that happens, and that'll be, they think, in about 170 million years' time, then all the water will be squeezed out of the Atlantic that we know and recognize today. It'll go somewhere else. I mean, the amount of water on the planet will remain the same, but the configuration will be different, and the Atlantic, born 200 million years ago, will almost certainly die in about another 170 million years, but will be long gone, of course, by then.
Let's go next on the phones to Heidi in Arlington. Hello, Heidi.
Hi. Hi there, Chris. I had a question, or maybe your guest could comment. Several years ago, I was reading a book, I believe, about Sir Francis Drake, and what a hero he was and his adventures. And I was talking to a woman from, I believe, the Dominican Republic, and the moment I mentioned his name, she told me, he's reviled in on her island because apparently she said that he came and destroyed all their written records about their history and destroyed their history. And so I was wondering if your guest could comment on that.
Thanks for your call.
Well, it's I don't know the specific case, so I don't want to flounder by pretending that I do. But I mean, the business of privateering and buccaneering, these sort of subsets of piracy, where the British government, notably among them, would, as it were, depute piracy to to be committed against other countries, Spain particularly, by British-flagged vessels, saying you're doing it freelance, but you can do it at our behest because we want to keep the Spanish people down or limited. That kind of thing went on a great deal, and Francis Drake was one of the people involved in this kind of privateering. And so the reputations of people like Drake are very different in different parts of the world. I mean, there are controversies, of course, about Drake in California, how far north he got, and so on and so forth, where he landed. But in the Atlantic, the reputation depends on the people he encountered and the kindness or the savagery with which he treated them. And clearly, whoever it was in the Dominican Republic felt, and probably legitimately, that he treated them very badly. And this kind of thing certainly did go along a great deal in the 16th century in the Atlantic.
Such an interesting reminder that we can think we know all the facts of history, but we don't necessarily know the emotions and the human stories tied up in it.
Yes, you're absolutely right. And without embarking on a very long story, I mean, there's a little island in the far south Atlantic called Tristan da Cunha, where I've been to a number of times, but I've been banned from ever visiting it again in my life, because in a book I wrote in the 1980s, I quoted from an earlier book written in the 1950s, a story which the Tristanian people do not want repeated. And I didn't know they didn't want it repeated, but I did repeat it in my book. And as a result of this, their feelings were hurt, quite legitimately, I think, although I didn't think so at the time. And so I'm banned from ever going to Tristan, which is terribly embarrassing, because I go down there often and have to lecture about this fascinating little island with just 200 people on it. But I give a lecture, all the passengers on the ship go on board, but I have to stand on the bridge and twiddle my thumbs because I'm not allowed to visit.
I guess there's no way to make it up to them.
I think not. I last sent a message, they now have email, and I sent a message saying I'm coming down in springtime, which I was doing last year. And all the people that were involved in the original story in the 1950s have passed away long since. But their memories are much longer, and they've said, no, you're not going to be allowed to visit on this occasion, or indeed ever.
Let's speak next with Rachel in Dallas. Hi, Rachel.
Hi. I was wondering if, with your take on history's human passages to new places and with our technology evolving the way it has, do you personally believe that we'll be able to make it out into space and make space travel a thing of nonfiction and not science fiction?
Yes, I mean, it's quite a stretch for me dealing with the ocean, but yes, of course I do. Whether one would find these places so compelling, I'm not sure. I mean, I'm a great fan of liquid water, and the fact that neither the moon, or particularly Mars, of course, which is the first one in our sights, appears to have no water sloshing about, would make it a less than attractive place for me to visit. But I think, rather like the Phoenicians going into the Atlantic Ocean in the 7th century BC, what drove them there was commerce. And I think what will drive humankind to the moon and Mars and beyond is probably the possibility of finding things there which we need back here on Earth. And so commerce will drive them too. But yes, I'm sure we'll do it.
I think what's so fascinating about your approach in this book is that while the Atlantic Ocean is indeed the central character, it's also one without its own inherent motivations. How did that play into the approach you took to writing about it?
Well, it was difficult in a way to decide how to structure a book like this, but in the end it was, as I think you mentioned at the beginning, Shakespeare who gave me the structure, because although Shakespeare had never been at sea himself, he'd probably never seen the Atlantic Ocean, mercifully he did write this speech, The Seven Ages of Man, and when I was flying over the Atlantic one day about 15 years ago, I had in my pocket, and I think I have it with me in my briefcase beside me now, a copy of a book by the former British Foreign Secretary, a chap called David Owen, and it was an anthology of poetry, and he had organized the poems that he loved according to the Seven Ages of Man, the Shakespearean speech, and he indeed called the book Seven Ages. And I thought, that is the way to organize this book. And remembering from school, it's infancy and school child, lover, soldier, justice, old man, and return to childhood, it seemed to offer a structure which, at least for me and the ocean, seemed to work rather well.
At the very end of the book, you write about a visit to a place on the Namibian coast, which is a great example of heroism on the Atlantic during the Second World War. Can you tell us about that?
Yes. This all started for me, actually, in Chile when I was on the coast of the Pacific in Patagonia, and I read a book one night, stormy night, and I read it from cover to cover and finished at about 5 in the morning, called Skeleton Coast. And it was about the wreck of a ship, a freighter, in 1942, which was driven onto the reefs in what is now known as Namibia, a ferociously difficult coastline, because if any ship is wrecked there, for about 350 miles, there is no water. And so it's likely that any wrecked ship, any survivors, will die of thirst. Well, this happened in 1942. There were about 60 survivors. They built themselves a crude shelter, and eventually they were rescued. But in the rescue attempt, there was a tug which came up. It was called the Charles Elliot, and it came up from Cape Town in an attempt to rescue them. And two sailors, one a Namibian called Matthias Coriseb, and one a young Scotsman called Angus Campbell McIntyre, tried to swim ashore to take a rope to the survivors who were on land. And both of them were swept away by the currents. Matthias Coriseb's body was found, but Angus Campbell McIntyre's body was never found. And I went down there to Namibia to find the wreck of the ship, which still exists, and to find this lonely grave site. It must be the loneliest grave in the world. And I was very, very moved by it, and I thought in the end I would dedicate the book to the memory of this man, Angus Campbell McIntyre, who was born on an island in the Atlantic in Scotland, came down to work beside the Atlantic in South Africa, died trying to rescue someone in the Atlantic, and whose body was swept away and lies somewhere in the Atlantic. He seemed to me to sum up everything about man's relationship with the Atlantic, and I decided to give him a small honor, if you like, by dedicating the book to him.
The new book by Simon Winchester is called Atlantic, Great Sea Battles, Heroic Discoveries, Titanic Storms, and a Vast Ocean of a Million Stories. Simon, it's always a pleasure. Thank you so much for spending the hour with us.
Thank you, Chris, very much indeed.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.
Think production team includes associate producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.